Hello there, and welcome to another LitBit. Welcome to my pod compadre, Adam Smythe. And today we're joined by two very special guests. The first time we've had two. Firstly, Alex von Tunzelmann, author of two books, Indian Summer, about the final days of the empire in India, and Red Heat, about America's relationship with Cuba during the Cold War. I said that with a question at the end of it because I can't read my own handwriting.
Right. Your facts are right.
And also the author of a series of blogs for The Guardian called Real History, in which she examines the historical veracity of various movies. And hopefully we'll be talking about some of those a bit later. And also we have Hallie Rubenholt here, who has written more books than I can really wave a stick at. But her first book, Harris's List of Covent Garden Ladies, which she also then turned into a documentary for television. Her sexual scandal interest continues with Lady Worsley's Whim. And then more recently, she's written Mistress of My Fate, which is a novel which was described by one reviewer as a full-blooded historical romp. Extraordinary where people get these phrases from. And we've gathered here today to talk about the subject of truth, which seems sort of ridiculously
high-minded,
well,
difficult,
ambitious for the three-minute podcast. And I was wondering if we could just start perhaps with thinking about what that means by looking at real history and what Alex does each week. And perhaps I was very taken by an example which you had recently, Objective Burma, just to pick at random.
A film made in 1945, just after the sort of retaking of Burma in the Second World War by the Americans as a sort of propaganda movie. It's got Errol Flynn in it and so on. But this movie became extremely controversial. And actually, I think even Winston Churchill may have objected to it publicly. Certainly, it was for a long time, it wasn't shown in Britain because effectively it attributed the retaking of Burma entirely to this small group of Americans. Whereas, of course, the soldiers who retook Burma were of many nationalities and predominantly sort of British and what was then sort of British Empire forces. So it was very controversial. And it's a classic example of how historical movies sometimes sort of try to push one particular political viewpoint.
So when you watched the film, did those sorts of gaps actually get in the way of you enjoying the film?
It's actually a very enjoyable film, to be honest. It's actually a very, very well-made war film. I mean, of course, because it was made just after the events, it's very accurate in many ways. I mean, it's got all the details, right? So sort of war geeks are going to be totally delighted to watch it because, you know, there's no sort of wrong model planes or kind of, you know, mistaken uniforms or anything like that. I mean, it's brilliant for those sorts of details. And actually, also, it's very good on the military culture of the time. It's quite rough and ready, and it doesn't really shy away from showing that the men are tired and they're miserable and depressed. And, you know, so it's actually a great war film, but, of course, not so great if you know what it's not telling you.
But if you have a sense of the facts of history and it's the way it's playing fast and loose, does that... What's your reaction? I mean, do you throw things at the TV? Do you get angry with it? Or do you just say, this is what's happened and you can still appreciate it? I mean, how much of a problem is it, I suppose, for audience people who know the history?
I mean, for me, it really depends on how or where it's coming from that they're changing history. Because, I mean, virtually every historical film changes something because the structure of a film that's 2 hours long, historical films tend to be longer than average, so maybe three, it has to fit a certain kind of form. And of course, history doesn't always neatly fit that form. So you expect that they're going to change certain things and maybe amalgamate a couple of characters, speed things up. And I think that's kind of reasonable because, you know, some leeway is kind of okay. I'm more worried about the ones where there's a political motive and it's being changed to put a certain viewpoint. And there's a lot in that category, which I think are far more worrying. And the ones that just get things willfully wrong is also a problem because, you know, you then find that this stuff seeps into popular culture and people start believing it. So actually, I do, you know, I can certainly get pretty annoyed. I mean, so a classic example of something that really did have me hearing something on the screen is in Troy. With Brad Pitt a few years ago, when they're fleeing, you know, as the Greek ships turn up, the Trojans are sort of fleeing around in the city of Troy, and there's a couple of llamas that bound past the screen. Now, llamas, of course, are Latin American. So, you know, Latin America was not in contact with Europe until 1492, Trojan War, 1250 BC. So, you know, there would be no llamas in Troy.
Why did they want to put llamas? Why didn't
we? Well, they filmed it, I think, in Mexico, and so clearly what was available were some llamas. Right. So, you know, but it's that sort of detail that does actually really irritate me, because it's not hard to get that right.
Absolutely. I totally agree. I mean, I've just, as I was sitting here listening to you, I was thinking of a couple of examples from my least favourite films, one of which was The Patriot with Mel Gibson, where an entire village of, well, an entire community of colonial Americans were locked in a church by the evil Bannister Tarleton and burnt. You know, as you do. I mean, there was no account. You know, there's no account that suggests that this ever happened.
And, well, of course, it didn't happen.
Of course not. You know, and it's something
you'd
that
know about
and,
it. If it
and, well, absolutely, and it's such an atrocity that it's really, you know, something which I would think people who were not familiar at all with the conflict would walk out of this cinema thinking, wow, that's really awful. I had no idea that had actually happened during the American War of Independence.
Right. And what's quite sinister about that scene as well is that they have that character, that British commander, say, this will be forgotten. So they're actually telling the audience, oh, you haven't heard about this because it's been covered up.
True.
And of course, it just didn't happen.
I mean, exactly.
There was one historian, Richard P. Snow, who's an American historian, said, you know, he said, well, if it did happen, do you think the Americans would have forgotten it? It would have kept us out of World War One. Yeah. I mean, no way did this happen.
Yeah.
And actually, Mel Gibson, of course, who was the star of The Patriot, is actually, he's pretty much my bête noire. I mean, he is,
every bad film you can think
really,
of.
Really, he has no respect for history. And actually, he really has the opposite. He kind of tries to use it for political ends a lot, which I really do find quite offensive.
Do you mean that Braveheart didn't actually sleep with the Queen?
Sleep with the 9-year-old French Queen that was in France when he was in Scotland? No.
Or with the llama, which is in the cat scene.
No, no llamas.
Again, you know, on my list of least favourite historical films, I think right up there at number one is Titanic, because Titanic is a perfect example of that abuse, which, you know, James Cameron spent an absolute bomb researching what all the rooms look like on the Titanic, what people wore, you know, at what minute what part of the ship was sinking. But he invested nothing in actually making these early 20th century characters seem in any way real. I mean, they were comic strips.
And the other thing about that's fascinating about Titanic is that there are many, many museums to the Titanic film, the Titanic experience, they're usually called, which are museums initially about the film, but then at a certain point, I think they forget that it's actually about the film, and it becomes a kind of more authoritative seeming museum to the Titanic and that tragedy. And that there's this weird, interesting slippage between the film and the event.
There's a massive problem as well, which is Leonardo DiCaprio, I think, who I think ruins a number of historical films. I was thinking about J. Edgar and Gangs of New York, where the relationship between him and Cameron Diaz could only happen, I think, at some point early in the 21st century, because they're like totally bitching. But you have to believe that these two people are, and it's a problem with casting that to find actors who actually look historically accurate.
I know. Well, this is the thing is, and again, you know, is there ever an excuse for getting it historically wrong? I think the answer is yes in some cases, because
what would that excuse?
Well, I think what we have to realize, as Alex mentioned, is that there is, first of all, history, while a lot of the stories within history are fantastic and can work as standalones and can just be, could, you know, incidents in history which just could be dramatized on their own merits, there are times when you have to make the story fit the medium. And film is a specific medium. You know, you can't have people sitting there for kind of 17 hours while things, you know, unravel in real time. At the same time, there has to be a certain amount of dramatic build-up and all of this. But having said that, I still think that a real flagrant disregard of facts that we actually know that could work if a little bit more thought was applied to them. You know, they shouldn't be discarded in that willy-nilly sort of fashion.
Can I ask you about that really interesting first category when you're trying to squeeze historical truth or historical record into a sort of shape or a medium that it doesn't quite fit in, and what you have to do to it? So in your writing of historical novels, presumably there's, I don't know, maybe there's a research moment when you're reading stuff and reading memoirs and diaries and documents, and then you come to sort of narrativize it or put it into the form of a novel. Mm. And is there a moment where you, an uneasy moment or a creative moment or a kind of euphoric moment, I don't know, when you're conscious that you're molding it and you're turning it into something which is clearly in some ways true and engaged with what the research you've done, but in some ways is a bit of a leap.
It's interesting you should say that, because I'm actually facing that problem right now, today at my desk, because the novel that I'm writing, which is the second novel in the series of the follow-up to Mistress of My Fate, which is called The French Lesson, takes place during the early days of the French Revolution and the onset of the Terror, and specifically focuses on the Duke d'Orléans and the circle around him. And the Duke d'Orléans was accused by the court of funding the revolutionaries, and he was hated and loathed and despised by Marie Antoinette and Louis XVI, and nobody ever tells his story, because it's not fashionable to tell an 18th century French revolutionary story from the eyes of somebody who's so vilified. It's always Marie Antoinette. Mm-hmm. But not only that, I mean, obviously we know where he was at specific times, and then there are gaps as well.
What do you do with a gap? I mean, do you just put
I think this is the novelist's prerogative to be able to embellish. But the joy of this, coming at it with an historical body of knowledge and with a historian's hat on, you know, the joy of it is to be able to fill in the gaps plausibly and to think, well, it's probable that this did happen or this is believable. And actually, I think the best historical drama does that. Something like Boardwalk Empire, which is just, or Deadwood, which takes real historical figures and then and some figures who are fictionalized and sort of weaves a narrative around what we know about, say, Al Capone, where he was at what particular time.
But what happens with both of you when you're writing your non-fiction work and you face the same problem, where there is a gap in the narrative? If you can't just have, I don't know, a spaceship land, a vampire come off and say, actually, it was Lee Harvey Oswald, which is certainly the idea for my next novel. If you can't, but what do you do when you're writing a work of non-fiction history? At some point, you must face the same problem. And how would you...
But in non-fiction history, I mean, you know, you can just say that this is the problem. You can say, well, the evidence
we just
on this,
don't know.
This is a problem. There's a gap here. And, you know, you can certainly, I mean, sometimes there are plausible suggestions for where someone could be. Sometimes there's a fragment of evidence. But you can be very open about that with your audience. Whereas, of course, making a film or writing a novel, well, writing a novel, you can probably bend the form a bit. But with a film, you sort of, because you need to, it's the visual medium is quite literal.
But it would be interesting, wouldn't it, for a film to do that, exactly that, and to play with this idea of a gap and we don't know, and these are the possibilities. And maybe there are instances of films that do that. I don't know, but that sounds like...
JFK, I suppose Oliver Stone and the sort of boom in conspiracy theories is that people pick apart those tiny little gaps,
JFK is a very bad example of extreme invention. I mean, you know, this is a film that invents witnesses, invents, you know, whole kind of theories, invents nonsense about magic bullets, which isn't true, and, you know, sort of eliminates a lot of crucial details, like Jim Garrison, its hero, feeding his witnesses barbiturates before he got them to testify. So, you know, it's actually, that film is particularly appalling in terms of what it does. And again, this is a very good example, JFK, of how films do affect public opinion, because it was very clear that when that film came out, that it really did help sustain this belief that there was a conspiracy behind Kennedy's murder, which, of course, has never been proved. And, I mean, actually, at the moment, you know, you can still, the Warren Commission may be a very, very flawed report, but its conclusions actually sort of still stand, I'm afraid. You know, there's no actual proof.
Stephen King thinks it was Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yeah, so do I.
It's Stephen.
Me and
it's
Stephen.
Good enough for him. Has there been a film about Princess Diana's death?
I mean, there will be. You know, and now we're seeing, of course, I mean, as Objective Burma shows, it's nothing new to have films very quickly about a historical subject. Actually, that's
Tony Blair,
something that's happened
Queen.
For a long time. Yeah, we've had Tony Blair, we've had The Queen, and we've had George W. as well, Oliver Stone's film about George Bush, better than JFK historically, although JFK is a much better film cinematically.
But those short-term ones must have an interesting kind of feedback loop into reality. I mean, if they're appearing when these people are still in office or when the events are still rumbling on and they create a narrative that may not be true in its origins, but that could become part of kind of public consciousness and how these people think of themselves and how they act in the future.
And I mean, you also have issues like, I mean, for instance, with the Margaret Thatcher film that was out last year, you know, a lot of people found that very problematic because it was sort of dealing with, particularly because it devoted a lot of its screen time to her kind of presumed Alzheimer's. And of course, a lot of people found that quite tasteless. I mean, you know, you've got this woman who, whatever you think of her, is still alive and obviously is in a state of some confusion. Is it actually that kind to make a movie about someone in that state that kind of then twists a lot of their own past? It also seems a bit, you know, a bit on the edge of taste, I think, for a lot of people.
Well, essentially what you're saying about the Burma film, you can actually being having your nose pressed up against a historical moment actually can perhaps distort it in a slightly different way.
Oh, it does. And it does with historical sources as well. I mean, any historian who deals with this stuff knows. I mean, I found it a lot when writing about the Cuban Missile Crisis that actually a lot of people in the Kennedy administration who wrote very quickly after that wrote memoirs. They're not actually that useful these days because their view was so one-sided because they couldn't know anything that was going on in Cuba or in the Soviet Union.
And there's a curious moment at the end of politicians' careers now when they seem to live anticipating that imminent memoir writing. And there was all that talk in the last days of Blair of his, well, last years maybe, or months of his concern with legacy and how he's going to be seen. And it felt like he was already seeing himself through the eyes of these future historians and living in that odd retrospective spotlight.
Do you think these films that have come out fairly recently are a way in which we are trying to make sense with the recent past and digest the recent past? Because it certainly reframes it in a different way. I have to say that after seeing the Margaret Thatcher film and also the Long March to Finchley, which was with Andrew Riseborough.
Yeah.
I suddenly, well, as somebody who did not grow up in this country during the Thatcher era, I did actually see her in a different way. However, my first port of call was the internet. Where do we go to get our facts
straight?
Where
is the source?
Where is the source? Well,
oddly, I go to James.
Well, oddly, I do have a source for the Long Road to Finchley, which I know the writer who wrote the screenplay, who said he completely invented this notion of a love triangle between Edward Heath, Dennis Thatcher and Margaret, which was sort of implied throughout, but as a way of actually explaining a broader story. Mm. Now, did that get to a different kind of truth about her own ambition at that time? And I think it probably did, and about being a woman in a very, very male world, and particularly the relationship with the Jeffrey Palmer character.
I sometimes wonder if, I mean, these recent historical depictions, they are almost a kind of genre of their own, I think. And I sometimes wonder if we have more of an obligation to get things right when they have occurred within living memory than something like Gladiator. And I mean, I think also, you know, this applies to something like the two examples of this on television, which right now, which one which irks me tremendously and one which just fills me with joy. And the one which fills me with joy is Mad Men. And because I find it so fascinating to talk about this with my parents who lived through the 60s and my parents who lived through the 60s. Saying things like, this is so right. This is exactly what we experienced. This is exactly what it was like. And it's very edifying. But then the flip side of that was watching the first series of The Hour, which I just think, you know, was one of those dark moments for British drama where I just put my head in my hands and just thought, you know, this is being touted as the British Mad Men and it falls so short. And it mainly falls short because, well, for a lot of reasons, but because I did not find the characters in any way believable.
But that's an interesting question. The sense of, do we have a greater moral obligation to recent events and to getting it right and to getting it more truthful than to the kind of more distant past? I don't know. I mean, I guess with recent events, my sense is that we're still fighting over the sort of the narrative is kind of up in the air, the kind of historical narrative for these very recent events and the definitive account of Blair or Thatcher or even the 60s is still not so kind of ossified and fixed. And even at a kind of fast and loose recent film, is just one voice among many, maybe. But perhaps with things that are in the more distant past, there's less of a sense of a kind of a corrective voice that's going to come along.
Well, I don't know, actually, because there are examples, you know, that are older. And the one that springs to mind is, again, I'm afraid, Mad Mel. But Apocalypto, film, which I particularly detest, which is, I mean, you know, it's about this kind of it's hard to say what it's about because it's supposed to be about the Maya in Mesoamerica, but it's actually sort of about the Aztecs because he's got all the details about the Aztecs rather than the Maya.
Oh, but who cares and who knows? It's
right,
all the same,
you don't know, right?
It?
Exactly. I mean, they're pretty much all the same as far as he's concerned. It also is set in the Maya collapse, this sort of thing that happened in the 9th century. And then, of course, the invading Spaniards arrive at the end, which naturally they did not do in the 9th century, seeing as there weren't even such people as Spaniards in the 9th century. So it's 600 years out of date. And it's with, and it's the wrong people.
And it's like video game history,
and
isn't
it? It's not a very good film, regardless. But I mean, the thing that upsets me about it is that you've got these Spaniards turn up at the end, and it's very much kind of posited in this film as if the Spaniards are turning up to save the people of Central America from their terrible societies and their appalling degeneracy.
They're Catholic, by any chance.
Yeah, they're bringing
Christianity. Yeah, they are.
With
they
them.
Have big crosses on their ships and all this. So, you know, I mean, that seems to me to be a very sinister message indeed. And quite wrong, of course, because what happened after the Spanish turned up was genocide.
One of the things that's interesting about what we've just been talking about is the idea of point of view, which I guess is central to the idea of truth. And it's interesting that notion of Hollywood making movies in which Americans tend to triumphantly solve the Enigma Code or liberate Jerusalem in the during the Crusades or whatever it is. And again, it's this notion of an American century and a half, I suppose, and the power of Hollywood. Are there films that you've seen where, from other countries, where that kind of historical point of view is being challenged, perhaps?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, all countries make films to kind of support their point of view. And I mean, you can certainly see it in Chinese and Indian cinema, actually, is that, you know, they make pretty triumphal films. I mean, China last year had this, spent a huge amount of money, biggest Chinese budget ever, on this Zhang Yimou film about the rape of Nanjing, which, and they got Christian Bale to star in it, you know, one of the most A-list actors in Hollywood. This enormous budget. And it was a total flop in the West. It just didn't meet what I think Westerners expect a Chinese film to be. But it was an absolute attempt to put a Chinese historical point of view very strongly in very Hollywood terms. And I think that's something you're going to see happening more and more, of course, as you've got, you know, China kind of globalizing. I mean, Xi Jinping, the new president of China, actually went to Hollywood a couple of years ago and really and had some meetings with some of these, you know, big Hollywood names. So that's very deliberate, and that's absolutely a current you're going to see more of. And, you know, India does it too. You see some Bollywood films that are pretty triumphalist about various points in Indian history as well, and often very partial to one side or the other. But, you know, this is nothing different from what Americans do. It's what everybody does who has the budget to do this stuff.
I just had to pick my 10 novels of the year for The Independent. And I think my favourite novel of this year, which was a complete surprise, because it wasn't something I wanted to read, it was something I was asked to review, and was Thomas Keneally's Daughters of Mars. It's a really extraordinary tale of, based on memoirs of Australian nurses, going to the First World War and having to operate on these poor dying soldiers. But what was interesting, actually, partly was it was an Australian take on the First World War, and there was a kind of larrikin sense of humour. There was a particularly funny, rather dark joke about when a lot of the soldiers and the nurses were going home on leave on a boat. As the nearer they got to Australia, people got more worried about going home, particularly with terrible disfigurements and injuries. So there was a suicide epidemic of people throwing themselves off the side of the boat. And they put some sentries on, and one of the Australian nurses says to shoot the people or to stop them committing suicide. And I thought that was, but it was fascinating to get an Australian take on this great war, which I'd never really thought about.
And I mean, actually, let's just remember Mel Gibson's one really good historical film moment, Gallipoli, which is a very, very good Australian take on the First World War. And actually, I think it's one of my favourite historical films. I think it's an incredibly good take on that battle, very moving and very accurate.
And it's a terrific, but actually, moment in the Keneally book, which reminded me that they're in Gallipoli for a while. I did think of the movie, but there's a wonderful bit where New Zealand, Australian, Indian soldiers get their first glimpse of the motherland. They're fighting for the empire, but they've never seen it. Mm-hmm. In fact, most of their ancestors have either been booted out of the place or they've had been invaded. And they see the docks at Southampton, and I remember the line is something like, they wondered if this is what they were going to be dying for. And it's a very, very strange moment. And I think Gallipoli is terrific about actually that it takes the trope of the pointlessness of the Great War and sort of multiplies it by putting it in that colonial setting or the colonised setting.
It's also got an example in Gallipoli of how how critics can actually be wrong about historical details. There's a lot of people got upset with Gallipoli because this commanding officer seems to have a British accent. And of course, the Australians were commanded by Australians. So, you know, people sort of said, oh, this is, you know, anti-British and all this. Well, actually, he just has a posh Australian accent. It's just, you know, a posh Australian accent in 1916 was a lot like a British accent. So, so, you know, actually critics were kind of wrong on that. The film actually had that right.
Accents in historical drama is fascinating, isn't it? The tradition of those films about World War II, in which you have Germans, the evil Germans, according to the film, speaking English, but with a English sense of a German accent.
The accent of history is English, as we know from Gladiator, really kind of set that in a modern sense. But actually, you know, that we now just presume that. And even something like Game of Thrones, which is, to be honest, you know, I mean, it's obviously fantasy, but is pretty much about the Hundred Years' War, Wars of the Roses and the Plantagenets. They all have to have English accents in that too.
Can I ask you a question in a different key, Hallie, about reviewers and readers and what they look for in historical novels and what they like and what annoys them? And is I mean, do your readers and your reviewers, do they give you a hard time? Do they go after you for historical accuracy? I remember when it hit the Hilary Mantel reviews, she kind of seemed to have to do all the history correctly and satisfy these historians who were reviewing her books. And then had to also do all the literary novel stuff correctly, which is, seems a tall order.
I think it's really hard to make everyone happy, I think, with anything, because obviously when you're writing, I mean, I'm in quite a difficult position with my first novel, because it is written as a first person false memoir, much in the way that Thackeray wrote Barry Lyndon. But of course, he was writing in the 1840s, and the way the liberties he can take with language, you know, is very different from what I can do. So I've done a sort of modified 18th century first person. And, you know, and most people, for the most part, buy it. It's a kind of watered down Tristram Shandy.
But does that, when you're writing, does that feel like a kind of tussle between authenticity and truth and the record and then this desire to...
It's a total tussle. I mean, it's really... I mean, I think the thing is, because I've spent so much time with my head in 18th century literature and that voice and the cadence of the words and the way in which writers express themselves, that I would love to just do a forgery of an 18th century book.
Because I'm getting root of a lot of money.
I really have this inner battle between, okay, what am I letting go of? And it's a learning curve every day. What am I letting go of? Am I going to concede that I'm really not going to know that much about the process of how letters were sent in France, and I just have to kind of let that one go and just go with the plot? And I'm constantly, you know, navigating, you know, this side of the line or the other. And ultimately, I would say a lot of my readers won't notice, and there will be some who do. But I think as somebody who notices it in books herself, and also as somebody who notices it in television and film, I feel that I have to be a purist.
I was trying to write something for an academic book about printing in the 17th century recently, and I thought it'd be fun to have a sort of somewhat speculative description of how a book was printed, and sort of almost a fictionalized account of being in the printing press, what happened, who was around, the characters and so on. But I almost immediately, and I thought I had a sense of the 17th century and how things got done, but as soon as I tried to get the kind of quotidian details down, I had no idea. I had no idea what kind of shoes they were wearing, what they just had for breakfast, you know, what the windows were made, or just the stuff that surrounds you, but is silent in historical record generally. I didn't have a clue, and it made me feel... that I don't know anything about the 17th century. And so I resigned.
I remember, I think it was Peter Greenaway said, well, look, the moment you point a camera at people pretending to be other people and they're reading a script which someone has written and made up, any sense of the idea of the truth has gone out the window. Mm. So you might as well have people walking through the room, which changes colour. And can you completely depart from the truth and somehow get closer to the truth?
But I love this interesting this topic of that you can be factually inaccurate but somehow get to a sort of moral truth despite that.
Yeah,
local
absolutely.
Which is fascinating, and it made me thinking about a book that about which there was a huge controversy in the States, that James Frey A Million Little Pieces, yeah, which was published about his supposed drug adult crime littered life in his 20s, not the 20s. And it had some success, and it was picked up by Oprah, wasn't it? And became her book of the week. And I think it was the first, some bizarre statistic, first book of the week by someone who was still alive. that she'd picked, which is slightly uneasy implications of that statistic. I don't know how. But and it was celebrated and became a massive bestseller. But then, of course, it was rumbled as a forgery and he'd made most of it up. But Oprah's initial response to it, which may have been pragmatic and self-serving, was that she said the underlying message of redemption still resonated with me. And there was this sense of it as a narrative, which was sort of morally true in some way, even though it was all a lot of nonsense. And these stories had told about being high on crack and having fights with police officers rather hilariously. Actually, he'd had a parking fine and got sort of a £15 $15 fine.
Well, I have a quote. It's a Keats letter. And I've just read Cold Comfort Farm, which is terrific. And then I was reading about her, which led me to Keats. It's very Keatsian, sort of clangy of associations. I'm certain of nothing but of the holiness of the heart's affections and the truth of imagination. What the imagination seizes as beauty must be truth, whether it existed before or not. For I have the same idea of all our passions as of love. They are all in their sublime, creative, of essential beauty.
On the other hand, I mean, I'm going to pull this round to another example, which for me would be that actually you can make a film, and I'm sure also a book or anything else, that's very factually accurate and yet doesn't actually tell you the story at all. Mm. And my classic example of this would be Steven Soderbergh's two Che Guevara films, which are both called Che Part 1 and 2, which are accurate to the letter of Che's diaries that they're based on the Bolivian period and the Cuban Revolution. But first of all, my God, they are boring. I mean, you'll have to sit on a pin to stay awake in them. But quite aside from that, they actually get nowhere near the man. I mean, you get no sense of him because it's a completely, it's so rigorous. His first wife doesn't appear. His second wife is on for a matter of seconds. Even Fidel Castro is a bit part. You know, none of the important political figures are in it. There's so little concentration on any of the big important events, the Bay of Pigs, the Cuban Missile Crisis. Anything significant is just ruthlessly edited out, and it's just hours of trudging through a jungle and being quite miserable.
And the sort of the converse of, if we're suspicious of big, bold stories being probably untrue, the converse of that is that boring stories are true, but that need not be the case at all. They might just be
boring. No, I mean, Che Guevara's story is not boring. I mean, but you know, this was a very boring take on it.
And Shakespeare, I'm really bad at how true Shakespeare is to any of those history plays.
Yeah, well, not very. I mean, Shakespeare's interesting, I suppose, because as we were talking at the beginning, I was thinking a bit about Henry V, his play Henry V, and the history of the productions. And it's probably of all plays, the play which gets made most crassly in the image of the moment of its remaking. And so you get it in 1945, just after World War II, and it's ultra patriotic.
Camp Frenchman with tennis balls, as I remember.
Yes, there are. That's right, Henri Leconte.
Didn't we have a Kenneth Branagh version?
We did,
as well?
and that seemed in its moment to be true because we were in a historical moment where we prized ambiguity, guilt, uncertainty, and so on, and it was offering that, and you can find that in the play. So that's why the play's a great play because it gives you the space to find all these things.
There's a new biography of Keats out, and it's one of the fascinating little bits of the story by Nicholas Rowe, out in the shops right now. But it's fascinating that someone who lived 25 years has had 9 or 10 or 11 major biographies, and I think you'd be hard-pressed to find really serious biographies, the last one, of course, being Andrew Motion's Meisterwerk.
Oh, yes.
But someone like Byron, whose life was perhaps more documented, doesn't get as many. Shelley doesn't get as many. Coleridge Wordsworth doesn't get as many. So what is it about this small little Cockney geezer? And of course now a major. Both. But I do have a problem with the biography thing, in as much as it gets terribly hard time, as though somehow biography is a misleading context in which to think about people's work, particularly in academia. And I think it's to do with the Roland Barthes Death of the Author essay. But why is, for example, politics a more interesting context in which to think of? Because it's one of the problems I have with that as a frame is the notion that these writers are going around thinking of nothing else other than politics. And if you're Ian McEwan and you're writing Saturday, then clearly that is all you're thinking about, because his main character sees nothing else but political allegories in his socks and his parking space. And
but I think it depends on the kind of literary text you're dealing with. I think it's perfectly okay and defensible to have certain kinds of biographical readings of certain kind of text. I don't have a problem with that. I don't buy the unequivocal total deletion of authors from the critical discussion. But if you're talking about, say, 1599 and Shakespeare and Henry V, to bring it back to that, you know, you're writing, we're talking about text at a time where there wasn't a conception of, any conception of pouring your life into a text. This is a pre-romantic idea of creativity. And, you know, that word invention in the Renaissance means gathering things that already existed, not making something anew. And that's a sort of good illustration of how authors thought about what they did, I think.
Well, I could whip my Keats out to whip my Keats out to
challenge
to challenge the idea that it's a romantic idea of Shakespeare, because Keats says exactly
no
the
I know we always use the romantic as a
I know
as
we
a
have
whipping
a fight. I mean, we'll have a fight.
I was reading recently T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets and the Little Gidding bit of that Four Quartets, and there's a line in that which really struck me when I read it, and that line is, it's two lines: dust in the air suspended marks the place where a story ended. Dust in the air suspended marks the place where a story ended. And I was really struck by this because I was thinking about Little Gidding in a 17th century context, and I was thinking about layers of history and where the past stops, etc., etc. I had all these lovely interpretations. And then I read this interview that T.S. Eliot had given about the poem, and he said, dust in the air suspended referred in this extremely literal way to the fact when he was an air warden in 1941 during the Blitz, he would go up on the roof in Russell Square and there would be dust everywhere and it would cover him. And that was a line evoking that very, very literal particular moment. And I was massively disappointed in him and in myself and in poetry and in the 20th century, everything. And I felt the poem was diminished as a consequence of this. So we were just having a little drink there and discussing over our mulled wine, spiced with cinnamon, that it's December and it's Christmas party season. We've got some, well, I've got no parties to go to, but some of the other people haven't. James, you're looking slightly under par today. I don't know if everything's, but what were you up to last night?
I spent the evening at the aptly named In and Out Club for the Literary Review's Bad Sex Awards of 2012.
Ah, what goes on there? What's that about?
Well, it's supposedly rewarding or I suppose berating maybe writers for producing the worst descriptions of sex in fiction. And this year, because of 50 Shades of Grey, there was much humming and hawing about why E.L. James wasn't nominated. But they have very strict dress code to get in, which you have to have written a literary novel rather than a piece of pornography.
So you have to be accidentally bad? Is that
well, it was an interesting question, actually, because what they do is they get actors to read out the certain passages. It was the sort of evening where the words like passages became loaded with meaning, if you catch my drift. And some of them worked better than others. And in fact, the winner was Nancy Houston with Infrared. And I think the reason she won, actually, was that she meant every bad image that she used. And in fact, it wasn't the sex writing was not the worst bits of the book. There's an extraordinary image of time where she compared to a slug and then followed the slug over several endless sentences.
Wow.
But what was interesting about hearing them read was that there were sort of more knowing descriptions of sexual congress.
And presumably it does good for the book. So there's at a certain point, there's a desire to win. I mean, if you haven't won the Booker, then the next sort of, you know, Division One rather than the Premiership aim is bad sex.
There are conspiracy theories that certain writers are trying to desperately to win the bad sex awards.
But, Mantel?
Not yet, I don't think.
She's pitching hard for it, I'm sure.
Yeah. Was there any sex in Wolf Hall? Which sounds euphemistic now, suddenly.
No, I can't recall. Hallie, Christmas parties?
Christmas parties. Well, tomorrow, Alex and I will be embarking on the Historical Writers Association Christmas party, which should be very interesting.
Well, hopefully it'll be fun. I mean, it's a bit of an unusual thing for us writers because normally we have to sort of get drunk on our own and then try and take advantage of ourselves around the back of the photocopier. So it's quite exciting to kind of, you know, have actually other people.
Other
to
human
party
life
with.
Forms.
I know. It's going to be quite weird for us, really. We might get carried away.
What happens at the historical writers?
Well, we talk a lot about Napoleon and Vikings and we get drunk. Well, no, I mean, there is a bit of that. But,
Napoleon and Vikings. Now, that's a movie pitch. Similar lines, actually. And it's funny thing is, actually, I find quite a lot of the time, historians that go and write historical novels feel fabulously as if they've been let off the leash, and suddenly they can sort of start making things up and they get very overexcited. Whereas actually people who are professional historical fiction authors who start like that are much more concerned often about getting things right than I think...
Why is there a... he knocks the wine glass. Why is there a kind of status problem for historical fiction as a genre? If that's the case, I mean, yeah, War and Peace, definitely. But I think also there is a sense of snobbishness among some critics about historical novels. Why would that be? It seems
I
curious.
I think they think it's dross. It's over-commercialised. It's the stuff that you buy in supermarkets and WH Smith, or you download for a penny on Amazon, it has very little merit. It's just kind of a sort of domain for the fantasists. But I think even worse than that, I think more sinister, I think there's an association with female readers, female readerships, and historical novels, which, anything that women... And my God, I mean, this has been going on at least since the 18th century. You know, there's this, you know, people who read Anne Radcliffe, you know, she was Gothic, but what she was writing was basically historical, you know, and noses being turned up at novels because mainly women were reading novels. But, you know, this seems to have carried over all the way through into the modern age. And, you know, there's a real disdain. And I have actually, I mean, like, it's palpable. I have actually experienced this, moving from writing nonfiction into fiction. And even the nonfiction I was writing, because it dealt with sexuality, the history of sexuality and the female and the male experience. But, you know, certainly with Lady Worsley's Whim, there was this sort of sense that, oh, right, it's another book about an 18th century woman. But actually, it's not a book about an 18th century woman. It's about a marriage and it's about a court case. There was some suspicion around that, whether that was worthy. It's this concept of historical writing and historical fiction being worthy.
But on the other hand, I mean, come on, The Booker of Bookers, Midnight's Children, that's historical fiction. I mean, actually, there's...
But it falls into a sort of literary...
But literary fiction is lauded over commercial fiction in every genre. I mean, you know, by sort of establishment.
But an interesting question, which is, this is going on with the Costa Prize, because some... a graphic novels have been nominated. There was recently the CWO, as you were saying, held an evening where Lee Child, John Banville and Sophie Hannah discussed crime fiction and similar. And what the question I keep asking about crime fiction and graphic novels, why do you care what literary fiction thinks about you? No one really reads literary fiction.
It does seem we're in an interesting moment with regards to genre fiction, where it seems to be a new level of interest and investment in it that there wasn't before.
Because I think there are fascinating and really wonderful things happening.
But also, literary, I mean, the other way to think about it, I suppose, is that literary fiction as a genre is a recent construct and doesn't really mean anything at all. I mean, the only definition I can think that works is that it's sort of non-genre fiction, but literary fiction itself has now become a genre where it's all about boring, quiet sufferings in, you know, North London homes.
Yeah. Exactly. And I mean, also you find that, you know, if you look kind of in the 1930s or something, there was much less of a distinction between these things.
There was virtually no distinction.
People just read books that were good.
So James is holding his much-thumbed...
My much-thumbed...
volume of Pamers.
Philip Larkin.
Yeah.
Who's been a bit of a ghost on the pod, popping up every now and again. Frank O'Hara and Larkin, probably.
And Keats.
James, what are you going to read?
It's called Talking in Bed. Talking in bed ought to be easiest. Lying together there goes back so far. An emblem of two people being honest. Yet more and more time passes silently. Outside, the wind's incomplete unrest builds and disperses clouds about the sky, and dark towns heap up on the horizon. None of this cares for us. Nothing shows why, at this unique distance from isolation, it becomes still more difficult to find words at once true and kind, or not untrue and not unkind.
Very nice. So... It's very Larkin-esque, isn't it? That sort of
it was.
Modifying of the last... You think you got to the last line, but then he caveats it into an even more precise last line.
And you'd sort of think, if you're in bed with him, that, you know, a quick cigarette and maybe, a box of roses. But distinctions between truth and not untruth. Yeah. A bit of Lytotes certainly gets
he
me.
He likes a bit of Lytotes, doesn't he?
He does a bit of Lytotes.
Is that legal?
It was then in Hull. But I think the thing is, I it's funny, I don't think of Larkin. I mean, well, I'm reading this poem biographically, which is, as we've said, very dangerous. But when I think of Larkin, I don't think of him sitting in bed with anyone. I mean, I think of him sitting in an armchair on his own, listening to jazz records and writing letters to Kingsley Amis. So it's an odd...
Well, thank you very much to Alex von Tunzelmann and to Hallie Rubenholt for their stamina and their insights on historical veracity. I'm off immediately to watch Braveheart and Mad Max 1 and 2 to see how they compare.
Beyond
the Thunderdome. But until next time, I hope you all have a very happy Mel Gibson experiences.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you.